Hello, and welcome to the Professional Insights Podcast, Season 5, Episode, I've got no idea. My
19
name
and 20, I just got my invoice.
Is it 19?
I got my invoice, so I know.
19 and 20, thanks. I think we got one more till the end of March, and then we're done the year because our fiscal starts. My name's Brandon Curry.
I'm Jeff Collins.
Josh Bond.
And Trevor Lindy.
I guess I'm Ben Sledge.
You are Ben Sledge. Now, award-winning author.
No.
Four tours?
No, I only had two, but they were very long tours.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And well, we're going to get on that too. There's so much I want to touch on. How would you like us to? You are a staff sergeant. So how would you like us to address you? Do you want it to be? We're being serious about this. Is it staff? We're not going to use your nickname because that's comes from the book, and I just think that also ties into the theme of the book. So I'm going to kind of leave that there, which is a kick-ass nickname. How would you like us to Sergeant Sledge or Staff Sergeant or?
Well, unless you retire, you don't get to retain your rank. So, I mean, unless it becomes an honorific and the military is like, hey, we're gonna let you have that. So it's just typically everyone calls me Sledge now. I have my former sergeant stuff on there, and people will refer to me as that sometimes, but it's not accurate. So Sledge is fine.
It's a badass name, okay. So I'd be happy awesome. To have that name too.
And that's yeah, I mean, I sounded like name. A G.I. Joe character while I was in the military. I was Sergeant Sledge.
It's like, it's almost like a made-up name, eh? It's a killer name.
Well, what's funny is I went on a clearing operation one time with a guy whose last name was Slaughter, and he was a sergeant. So it was Sledge and Slaughter that were the two guys leading an entire platoon of Marines.
Like it should be, basically.
Well, they were all like, we're going to kill everyone. And I was like, wrong mindset. No, names do not translate to.
Well, it's almost like it's preordained just because your name was chosen, right? There you go.
For everyone that's listening, so again, Ben Sledge, I'm just going to read a little bit from, I just wanted people to understand, and yes, I got to get my cheaters on, and yes, I'm old enough now, I need some bloody cheaters.
Hey, when did this happen here, Curry?
Oh, this happened like the last couple weeks there, bud.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Welcome to the club. My wife's going through it right now. She's realizing she's got to do it too. It's great.
Yeah, it is. It is what it is. I just accepted it. It is what it is.
Yeah. Just buy five or six pairs there. Throw them around.
Oh, this, yeah, right.
Yeah. I'm telling you. Christ, I'm telling you.
I know. I gotta. I don't.
One in your car, one in your office.
It's going to be bad. Ben.
Cheer up, it gets worse.
You are the recipient of the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, two Army Commendation Medals, served in Iraq, Afghanistan, basically, it goes into on returning home. He began to work in geopolitical intelligence and then moved into mental health. Certified in crisis response, trauma care, and suicide prevention. You continue to work with vets. You live in Colorado with your wife, daughter, and son. And you can go to his website, BenjaminSledge.com, which we will be promoting throughout the entire 2 hours here. Please, if anyone's we know everyone's going to be watching, drop your comments in here if you have any, and we'll answer them live. Buy a book, support a vet. Go to Amazon.ca, buy the Rookie. Do you mind putting up the book title for everybody? That way they can we can see it. That's just a badass picture. Like, look at that. Where Cowards Go to Die.
That's great book. Bruce Willis-esque, no?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, more badass than Bruce Willis, I think.
More badass than Bruce Willis?
No,
Bruce is bad.
That dude didn't die.
Real life Bruce Willis.
Real life Bruce Willis. Maybe not. Yeah.
As Canadians, we salute you and we appreciate what you've done.
Well, we appreciate the Canadians who served in the global war on terror as well. You guys have the longest sniper shot recorded in history right now.
And I bet you he apologized right after he did it too, right?
He did not.
Hey, wasted time, games. Thanks very much for logging in. Thanks for saying Ben is a badass. Please buy the book, Amazon.ca. So here's another thing too. A lot of people don't know. So Ben, there's a lot of ignorance surrounding writing a book.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk to people on you know, how the like just a brief process and what that means. And then let's go into your background briefly.
You don't sit down and just write it in one sitting and then it's done.
Yeah. So what does it mean? Like, how do you get on the Wall Street Journal and stuff like that?
It's difficult. So let me explain. So a lot of people are out there calling themselves best-selling authors. They're not. What happens is they'll get on Amazon, they'll release a book, and they'll have their friends and family or whoever will buy it. It'll jump up the rankings in a specific category, right? So for instance, for mine, mine for several weeks was on like number one in Iraq history, number one in Afghan war memoirs, number one in like memoir, whatever. And then you're like, oh, look, I'm a best-selling author now. Well, it's because Amazon updates all their rankings hourly. And depending on how many sales you can get to specific categories. Now, that does not mean that you are technically this best-selling author, whatever, because the real rankings are the New York Times bestseller, the Wall Street Journals, the big ones. And the way that you hit those lists is you basically need to sell 2,000 to 3,000 copies within the first month. Now, here's the reality of the situation. Most based on recent Department of Justice inquiry to a merger between Simon & Schuster and Penguin Random House, which are the largest publishing imprints in the United States and just worldwide, they discovered that 90% of authors never sell more than 2,000 copies ever in the history of their print being an edition. So the reality of the situation is to hit those lists is kind of very difficult, as well as getting you can be an award-winning author, and even then it's hard to hit those lists. But the time, effort, and energy that it goes into writing a book is difficult because of the simple fact that you're conducting research, you're having to sit down and write. And if you're like me and you have kids, you have to figure out a time when you can do it to where they're not like barging into the room and you know, getting out of your train of thought. So the way that I did it, I had a full-time job, you know, because typically writing a book does not pay the bills. I'm just going to be honest, like unless you're Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, that's it. Then you've made it. Like even N.K. Jessamyn, who wrote the Broken Earth trilogy, she is a Hugo winning Nebula, the whole nine yards. She had to keep a full time job, even though her books were winning all these awards and hitting certain lists. Until she signed a seven-figure contract with like Sony Pictures to adapt, hers was the time when she was finally able to move into full-time writing. So it's oftentimes for not to burst anybody's bubble, you should write because you love it, not because you want to be a bestseller or whatever. But I would wake up every single morning around 5:30 in the morning and I'd write for an hour, and it took about a year to complete an 80,000 word manuscript. Granted, when I finished, it was about 100,000 words, which is about the size of a fantasy novel, and I had to cut about 20,000 words. So that's the reality of writing.
True to anything though, you should do what you love, right? Makes it easier.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think people get the wrong idea where they're like, oh, I'm going to be this musician, or I'm going to be a writer or whatever. And my writing mentor, he's one of my best friends. He's actually a Wall Street Journal bestseller. And I asked him how he became, you know, a writer. And he said, well, first you have to ask me how many times I've been rejected. And I was like, oh, okay. And so he took me through this thing, and he's like, right now in our city, there's probably like 100,000 people that want to become writers. Of that 100,000 people, 50,000 people will actually sit down and write something. It'll be terrible because it's their first time. And then from there, that number will continue to dwindle until there's maybe actually 100 people that are serious about writing. And he said, now ask me how many times I've been rejected. I was like, how many times have you been rejected? He's like, close to 600. And I was like, and so for him, it was just perseverance pays off.
You know, and so that means basically the Cryer Media Network, we have thousands of people that subscribe to YouTube channels and podcasts throughout the network and stuff. So we actually have the power to make you a bestseller.
I hope so. That would be dope.
And so come on, everyone. It's $35 Canadian.
Love that. That would be sick.
Yeah. So anyone that's watching in America, click this link right down at the bottom. I don't know how you do that, but just click the link. That's what I did. And you can go to Amazon and buy it. And you know, it's $35 Canadian with Prime free shipping. And then that's like $5 American. So like I'm, you know, I'm a finance guy. I'm sure that the exchange works out that way, something like that. But, and on top of that, you also have made your, just for our podcast and our listeners and stuff, you've made your website at benjaminsledge.com to get a signed copy. Also, you've made that live to, for our podcast. You can get a personalized signed copy like I did right here.
There you go. Is,
right there. That was really nice of you to do that.
See, I didn't know about that. I bought it way earlier than Curry, so I was reading it a long time ago. I'd like to say one thing, too. Don't just buy the book to support a vet, which you should do anyways. It's a hell of a book. It's a hell of a book. And the way I've always looked at books myself, I love reading books and all that, but I'm particular about books. Usually they find me. I don't find them. And if I like a book, I can't stop until it's done. And if I don't like a book, honestly, I don't finish it. And I finished this book in 4 sittings. It was a hell of a book. It was a great story. I think the biggest way to encompass the book is pretty much the first page on here. It says, for Kyle and for my children who will one day ask, Daddy, what was it like to go to war? This is what it feels like it would be like to go to war. Hell of a book, Ben. Sledge, I'm sorry. Hell of a book. I loved it. Sledge sounds badass, so I'll call you Sledge if you like that. But it was a hell of a book.
And the Canadian nickname can be Sledgy, right? If you played hockey, you'd be Sledgy, right?
I've already apologized once here. I said sorry.
Jack like a hockey player, so it's perfect. So it's fine. You're great. And you're in shape like one, too. It's good. Talking animals.
And the sniper would apologize for the kill.
Nah.
They'd apologize for taking that split second too long, probably.
Listen, I think it's, you know, in the last chapter, we're going to, you know, cover the book, but I want people to buy it. I second Jeff's comments. And that is basically, I'm not much of a reader myself. Like it takes me a lot to get into a book. Like Jeff, it was me for more. It was like 4 or 5 sittings, but still finished the book. One of our guests and people who avidly watch the podcast, Jeff Chesbro, former guest, and Jesse! he also bought a signed copy as well. Yes, Jeff, I finished the book, buddy. Okay, because he's only for 25.
I can't bug him.
He's not going to believe you. He's not going to believe you.
No, I know he won't believe me, but that's okay. He'll.
I'm going to give you a test later on. Make sure you got every chapter. I don't want to know this bullshit like you skimmed.
Okay,
you better read every word.
I did not skim it. I'm giving it to my. We're going away. I'm going to give it to my wife because my wife is a psychotherapist. And I said to her, I go, like, hey, if you ever do get a vet or if you ever do get someone with severe PTSD, I go, this book would really help you in your practice to kind of give you context to how to handle and what these people are going through. And I just think if anybody, and I said this to you, Sledge, I go, after thanking a vet for their service, there's only 2 questions and 2 questions only you should ever ask a vet. And that is, what are you drinking? And can I buy you a drink? That is it. That is, if they want to talk about the war, then ask them about the war. This is not we were joking before we went live on air. This is not Call of Duty to these people. They, you know, these people have, these men and women. I also can't stand when a politician says they've served their country. No, you didn't. You worked for the country. The vets served the country.
Your life is on the line, you serve.
Yeah, you've served. When your life is on the line, you've sacrificed. And my God, than what you've gone through. And I'd read a chapter and I'd be laughing like all the pranks that you make. Cause it just reminded me of the hockey dressing room. This is this stuff that guys do even, you know, in unisex washrooms, it was hilarious. I was laughing going, yeah, I could see myself doing that. And then like the next chapter, it was like a gut punch and you're like, oh my God. And I had to stop.
Everyone says
and I had
that.
To just, I'm like, it was a roller coaster. I was like almost on tears. I was laughing. I was snickering. Jeff, I don't know about you. What were you like while you read the book?
Oh, I loved it. I liked every part. There was funny parts, but to me, it was a redemption story for you at the end, which I really liked. I don't want to ruin it or anything like that. But I was like, when's the movie come out? I want to see the movie. And I don't think the movie's ever as good as the book. And you said Harry Potter before.
They'd have to do a mini series for this one. It'd have to be like
even better, a mini series.
Too many characters and timelines competing with each other. So
a modern we got to get him in touch with Ives. With a more serious, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I would love to get him in touch with Ives.
Yeah. Like Canadian icon Ryan Reynolds, who's looking to buy in the Ottawa Senators, which we fully support, Ryan. If you're watching our podcast, fully support you buying the Senators and love you owning the Premier League team. What? Why are you shaking your head?
Everyone has always said, like, I remind them of Ryan Reynolds, like my humor. I'm like Deadpool in a.
Yeah,
you've got the Matthew McConaughey Reynolds? Voice, though, too. I can hear
that. Everyone says that. Everyone says I'm Matthew McConaughey. I get all the time.
You're the
you
voice
need to
right
buy
away.
The rights to this book and make this movie. Reynolds, buy the book, make this movie.
And it's a great title. You know, great title, too. That's an intriguing title
He's
right
He's probably
there.
Not watching. Yeah, but if anyone knows the guy,
we
can
should
send
definitely
him
talk about the title at some point.
Yeah, well, how'd you come up with the title?
Go.
So the title, so, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but... So while I was in Iraq, you have a lot of downtime, so you read a lot or you watch bootleg movies. So I started really reading voraciously while I was overseas, and I picked up the book I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Now, it is anywhere close to the Will Smith movie. That one's trash. The I Am Legend is about the last man on Earth, and everybody else has been basically turned into vampires. So he's this last man on Earth, but the last three words of the book are I Am Legend. And I was like, I closed the book and I was like, that was freaking awesome. If I ever read a book, I'm going to do something similar. And so I had this idea in my mind of, and the lesson that I learned in war that translated into life is that in life or in war, you will either live or die as a coward, or you're going to have to kill the inner coward that's inside of you. But either way, a coward has to die. So for me, when I first left for war, I was really afraid. And I let a lot of cowardice eke into my system. I did things that degraded the morale of my teammates and my company. And it was just because I was afraid. But in order to do my job, I had to kill that inner coward so I could become selfless and serve them and serve something higher than me. So that coward had to die. Or if I had done the opposite, I would have just died a coward. And so for me, I realized that in life and in war, you will either live as a coward and die that way, or you'll kill that inner cowardice, the thing that is stripping you of your humanity, of that selflessness towards your fellow man. And that coward will have to die, and that way you thrive. And so I kind of end the book with kind of the homage to the title, Where Cowards Go to Die.
Yeah, I just checked it, and you did, yeah. I just checked the book. That's powerful.
That's so powerful. Oh, my God.
That's everything stripped down to a sentence, basically, and you got it bang on. Because I would not make it very long in war, I think. I might have a panic attack and die on the plane there. That's the way I would think I would happen, right?
It's always so funny because you guys are like, you guys have been through such a lot. And I think about the guys I served with, and it was just so normal to us. Like, and now everyone's like, good God. Yeah. And I think about my granddad, you know, he was a paratrooper in World War II. That was just normal to them. And we looked at him, we're like,
I got a question for you, Sledge.
I like how you wrapped it up, though, right? I like how you wrapped it up, because I think even in day-to-day life, we genuinely walk amongst 95% cowards.
Oh, sure. I think it's gotten easier to not deal with your issues. Like, I think that's why you're seeing such a mental health crisis. And even among the veterans, and I think that's the most devastating part for me, is watching the veteran community suffer so much. And here's what's crazy to me, is we literally have veterans walk into the Department of Veteran Affairs and they go, you are strong enough to fight a war, but you're not strong enough to be a productive member of human society anymore. So we're going to put you on mood altering drugs that put you in an alternate reality because now we think you're weak. And what's courageous about that? We should be confronting what we went through, which is what I had to do. And I had to go through a lot of counseling, a lot of therapy to get to that point. But you can either stay in that situation and die the coward, or you can face the trauma and the hurt and discover healing. from that. And that's the travesty. I think that transcends also into the civilian population, unfortunately.
Which your message is, you've got to talk about it, right? That's the big message, right? Is you just open have up. you have to talk about it. And that's what you talk about at the end of the book, right? Where you start meeting your fellow veterans and all that, right? After to discuss it, rather than not see them again until a funeral, you're starting to see them on a yearly basis, right? Which I think is a powerful message right there.
It was a funeral that changed everything, but that's jumping ahead. So let's go back to the beginning.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, let's just go into one of the quotes by that's at the very end of the book. You know, that kind of summarizes everything, and then we'll kind of walk through it all, which is William Tecumseh Sherman. And I'm going to read it verbatim so I don't get it wrong. I am tired and sick of war. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, for vengeance, for desolation. War is hell. And it just kind of summarizes I'm going to group politicians into this as well. Like the people who say, let's go to war, let's send these men and women into war, you know, or whatever. And the people who are like, yeah, but they've never picked up a gun. You know, they played Call of Duty. But I found, typically I'm a big business book guy, right? And I told you that before, but this, like, and very much Bondo touched on this. There was so many bridges into the business world about the coward piece and about how you can persevere. And so it was just really cool. So I'm going to ask a couple, but so for anyone that's watching, any questions, please drop them in the chat. Again, please go to Amazon.ca and buy the book, or Amazon.com and buy the book wherever you are. Buy a book, support a vet, and it's one hell of a book. So your whole family, great-grandfather, like there's a lineage. So take our listeners through that and on, everything.
Yeah, so in the military, we joke that military service runs in the blood. And so we started like tracing my lineage, and my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, has traced her side of the family back as far as a general who served under Napoleon Bonaparte. Wow. So you have that. And then from there, I started researching, like getting on ancestry.com and looking at like who my ancestors were from like the Sledge clan and then also the Whitson clan, which is my mother's side. And all of us had fought in basically every single major conflict in American history, from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. We were fighting each other at that point because the Sledge family was from the South. Whitson was from the North. kind of funny how that works out. And then, you know, my great grandfather, Cortland Joseph, he fought in World War I, I believe. And then my other great grandfather from my mom's side, he fought in World War I in trench warfare, and he died because of the complications of his service overseas. My grandfather was a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne he was one of the first paratroopers to go through like the program training. Still got all of his like pictures. I mean, it literally looks like Band of Brothers. It's crazy. So he fought in World War II. My grandfather, from my dad's side, was also in World War II, but he stayed stateside at Fort Bliss. But my great uncle, which is his brother, stormed the beaches in the Pacific with the army during World War II. Both my uncles were in the army during Vietnam. My dad tried to enlist into the Air Force, but was during Vietnam, but was disbarred because he had asthma. And then both my brother and I have served, and we have the distinct feeling that our kids will probably serve as well. So that's the history. Wow. It runs in the blood. We don't know why.
So
all his kids.
I cower. And I mean, like all of us are fathers on this show right now. How are you going to, reading this book? How are you going to do that? Like, how are you going to be able to look
so that their children don't have to? And unfortunately, history repeats the cycle.
Wow. And have you thought about that? Are you still thinking about that? Are you still trying to digest that? Like, because you jokingly and facetiously have said that.
But how do you close that loop?
How do you close that loop? How do you stop the cycle? Or evidently, I don't think we'll ever be out of. Yeah. What have you thought about that? And I just push us back if we're going to somewhere you don't want to, because I know that I would bawl my eyes out if that happened. So
yeah. I mean, you know, the thought of even losing your children is devastating. Just thinking about it's terrible. I've come to tears before just even thinking about it. My kids are fine. Like, they don't have health issues or anything. But part of being a parent is letting your kids grow into their own person and who they want to be. And you can do the best that you can. And there's pride in there. You know, my grandfather was so proud of me and my brother the day we graduated from basic training in the Army. He was just proud. And I know I would be too. Like, I would love to see even my daughter become like one of the first, like, there's so few women in like the special operations community. I'd love for her to go to like Ranger school and go through the gauntlet and have her prove that, but she may not, you know, she may want to go. She wants to be a musician. And they may not join the military, and that's okay. I think the way that you end the cycle specifically is, and I write about this in the end of my book, because I talk about the debacle that Iraq and Afghanistan became, 20 years of war for like literally what, you know, and it's devastating to us.
Oil.
It's foreign policy is really what it boiled down to, you know,
politicians and, again.
Yeah. It's politicians. And again, the greatest travesty, that we see is that we send our young to die based on the whims of men and women that have never served in the killing fields. Like, you have old men and old women whose fingers are in the cookie jar of lobbyists and corporations that go, oh, we need to protect our interests overseas with Kellogg Brown and Root and the rest of everything else that went on there, even from, you know, the mercenary contracts that we did with Blackwater to Triple Canopy to DynaCorp. It was all State Department sponsored. And if you go to opensecrets.org, which is it's a bipartisan nonprofit that looks into the finances of our politicians in America. You'll just see that all of them are being funded by these lobbyist groups. And a lot of our foreign policy moves are not specifically to make the world a better place, but it's so that these politicians can advance their careers, become rich in their careers, have, you know, whatever they want. So my solution, and you fix this, and people would hate this, is it's simple. It's you have mandatory service for 2 years, the same way that Israel and Germany used to have. And then two, you cannot serve as a congressional representative unless you've served. And that's it. Sorry.
Ooh, because that's a good one. I like that.
You're going to be a lot less likely to send your buddies and your young kids off to war when you've experienced it yourself. And
that's totally true.
Yeah. So that's how you close the cycle. Will it ever happen? Hell no. So, but that's the solution, and it would work.
I mean, it's just, we live different lives, man, right? Plain and simple. You're an American, I'm a Canadian. We have the benefit of being your neighbor, you know what I mean, in that sense. So we don't grow up necessarily with the same mentality. Not that, listen, I'd be the first one that, I've got two young girls. I'm the type of person that I'll grab a gun and I'll go. That's just my personality, right? If my kids are being stripped of something, listen, at the end of the day, I'll do what I got to do. But I don't want to do it. I don't grow up thinking about it. And it's something that I think us Canadians benefit from that we really don't pay enough homage to. Because we really don't.
Maybe that's why we say sorry all the time, right?
it's possible, right?
It's difficult. It's
not to say that we wouldn't back you guys, or there wouldn't be a good mitt full of Canadians that would be backing you guys, but it's just, yeah. it's not as ingrained, right? Like, it's just,
I don't think it's ingrained different. I don't think the warrior ethos is ingrained in the majority of the population in the United States. Less than 1% of the, so here's a reality check for you. 13% of the population in the United States is Black. And then you have Asian, and then American Indian, and Alaskan Native is about 1.3%. Guess who served in 20 years of war? Like, what percentage of Americans served in that? It's 0.86%. We are the smallest minority in U.S. history. And yet, so like, the warrior ethos is not ingrained into the American society. I think violence is, unfortunately. And the thing is we have this tendency to glorify it with either video games or, you know, movies or whatever it is. But when you see death and destruction up close and personal, that will F you up really bad.
Yeah.
We have some questions. So first of all, thank you everyone for tuning in. Again, please go to amazon.ca, order the book, Where Cowards Go to Die. Buy a book, support a vet. And also, you're also supporting a vet who takes care of other vets as well with PTSD. So that is that's a big thing. It's not just
huge
giving someone a livelihood. You're allowing Sledge to continue his work. So Wasted Time Games, thanks. Like these people that I'm listening, they're constant listeners and watchers, and they always ask questions, and we really appreciate it because without them, we would not have a podcast. Wasted Time Games, Kids Change Everything, totally agree. You Mad Bro, that's a great idea, which is the whole politicians can't be politicians unless they've served. Mm-hmm. But he did say, they said, that children quote got me, that's insane. Talking Animals, how has your experience as a war veteran influenced your writing, and what was the most challenging aspect of writing about your experiences? Great bloody question.
Oh, that's a great question.
Can I just tag on to that, Sledge? Because sure. Part of my questions writing down here was, in along this lines, you're a very creative guy. How does that impact, or did it impact you on the field? So it's just kind of maybe a two-parter.
Yeah, so we'll go into my background real quick, because this is important. This will be the start to the book. I grew up as a kid, you know, I'm a, like, on the cusp of Gen X, millennial, they call us Zennials, or the Oregon Trail generation. So I had an analog childhood and grew up in the 1980s. My dad was one of the original guys who worked with AIDS patients when nobody knew what was going on.
Which is so moving in the book.
Yeah. And so and the reason why is my dad was a Christian. I was raised in a Christian household. And we'll get into, we have to talk about spirituality and war because it's very important and we miss out on that. Carl Marlantis, who's a New York Times bestseller, who wrote What It's Like to Go to War, really kind of influenced a lot of my thought process throughout this. But, so, you know, I'm a young kid in the 80s and he's working with AIDS patients and everybody thinks it's airborne. You can get it by touch. And his faith informs him that he should take care of the poor and the marginalized. And so he's working with predominantly, you know, homosexual men and women and drug addicts. And the church at the time is like, hell to the no. Mm-hmm. And then the populace at large is scared to death that they're going to get it. And my dad knows better, you know, he's a nurse. He understands like how this stuff works. It's like, you know, you'd have to get it through blood, you know, sexual transmission, stuff like that. My family kind of becomes this social pariah outcast, where at one point I walk in to the kitchen and my mom's crying because her friends are deciding whether or not they can stay in contact with my mom and my dad, because my dad works in the AIDS wing of the hospital.
And he's trying to help out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's trying to do the Christian thing.
Yeah. He's the trying Jesus to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I walk in there and I remember I'm little. I have my little G.I. Joe character in my hand, which is kind of funny. It's foreshadowing, you know. And I go, Dad, why can't you just not help these people? And I'll never forget what he said. He said, if we don't, who will? And he goes, how could I possibly call myself a Christian if I didn't? And that really stuck with me. But I was always the creative kid growing up, like, because my dad was. My dad, in addition to being a nurse, like, he played piano, he sang, he loved to draw, and he was a very good artist. And so I picked up on all those things. And so I enrolled in as many art classes as I could. I loved music, and I loved metal. And so at the height of, like, the 80s, you had this thing called Satanic Panic that kind of kicked in. And was like, if you listen to metal, you're going to worship the devil and, like, kick puppies and do math. Yeah,
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of became ostracized in that respect. And because I was like, I loved art and I loved, you know, drawing. And at the time, I was a shy kid who would often, you know, stare at his feet. I got picked on a lot. And so, you know, and then I got into, like, the grunge and the metal scene. And because I wore my hair, like, long down to my shoulders. I was in, you know, band t-shirts and J-Co jeans. Yeah, it was Cobain and Nirvana and Soundgarden and, you know, Metallica's Black Album and then Pantera, Sepultura, you know, Anthrax.
All great.
Like the
big all four, great bands.
You know, Megadeth. So,
all great ones.
I started getting picked on, and, you know, kids were cool back then, and they would call you, you know, art faggot, skate fag, you know, stuff like that. And eventually I just felt like I got picked on and beat up. I felt like I had to change who I was. And so I chopped off all my hair and got blonde tips and started dressing like Abercrombie and Fitch so that I could, like, fit in. And I figured, I was like, being creative is not acceptable. And, for me, a lot of it was I was like, well, you know, we do the military in our family, and I had to figure out a way to pay for college because my parents were like, you're going to college. So I was like, I guess I'm going to join the army. And, you know, never in a million years did I think that I was going to go to war, because I joined in 1999. That was peacetime army under Bill Clinton. And so, you know, my first like 2 years are like, we're barbecuing, we're having camping trips, which are, you know, bivouacs is what we used to call them back in the day, to where you're doing exercises out in, like, the forest and stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, you're barbecuing and drinking beer. It's so chill. It was so much, it was fun. And it was just kind of dumb. And I had enlisted in a special operations detachment, not knowing what the hell it was, but just because I had scored high enough on my deal. And then the towers fell. And that really changed my life. And the creative guy had to become, like, kind of more of the warrior. But I was still, you know, deep down inside, I always knew I had that creative soul, like, that loved music, that loved art, that loved writing and poetry and stuff like that. But I was like, that guy's unacceptable. So I have to embrace this warrior aspect. And so in 2002, I got sent to Defense Language Institute, Foreign Language Center in Monterey, California, because in our skill set, we have to know another language as well. And graduated from there. And then 3 months later, they were like, yo, you're going to Afghanistan. And I was really afraid. Yeah. And we had just invaded Iraq too. So, and I knew we were invading Iraq because my entire unit was already gone, but because I was in language training, you know, I didn't get called up because I was already on orders. And then the next thing I know, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm probably going to Iraq. And they're like, you're going to Afghanistan. And I'm like, okay. So I get out, I arrive in Afghanistan, and I'm really afraid. I'm super afraid because I'm deep down, I'm still the creative kid that's trying to put on this brave face and this bravado, and I'm kind of, you know, fratty and the whole deal. And I'm trying to be the man. But I try to get out. I get attached to what's called a civil affairs team alpha. And that was my job, where you work with, like, the local indigenous population, you're a geopolitical expert, language expert, the whole nine yards. And, my team sergeant, a guy named Paul Gonzo Gonzalez, he's not, ironically, he is not Hispanic. His wife is, what's funny is his wife is Hispanic. He is a pasty white Irish American. So it's super funny. But this dude, I mean, he's the Iceman, dude. He's just, and still one of my best friends to this day. But like for him, war was just something he inherently understood. So he wanted to go to the border to like this really dangerous place where like all these stars and explosions were. And I was like, I do not want to go there. So I try getting out, and I wake up from a nap when we arrive in Kandahar while we're getting ready to go out to our respective forward operating bases. And he's pissed. And, you know, he's putting together his rifle and slams it down and is looking at me. And I'm just like, uh-oh. He's like, walk with me, Hollywood. And Hollywood was my nickname. And we'll gloss over that for now. You can ask in a minute because this is an important thing. So we go out to this area, and we're in Kandahar. And this is like early on in the war effort. It's not like what you see now. So there's just twisted mass of wreckage. And there was this area, they had built this like mass of metal wreckage, and somebody had crudely spray painted Thunderdome. And when soldiers got it beef with each other, you just go in there and beat the shit out of one another, like just fucking just kill them. And so he brings me over near Thunderdome, and I'm thinking I'm gonna get my ass beat. And he takes this kind of, instead of the sergeant voice, he takes kind of more of the soft dad voice. And he's like, Hollywood, I know you're scared, and I'm scared too. He said, I'm scared to lose it, you know, leaving my wife and kids behind. But I need you. I need you out there. You've trained for this. You know what you're doing. And we're going to get all on that helicopter tomorrow, and we'll all come back together. But I need you. And that really changed things for me. And I went out to the border and started seeing combat. And I actually really thrived well in the combat environment, found that I liked it. Because there was just like this adrenaline rush to like being shot at and being rocketed and explosions everywhere. And when you come out of it alive, you never feel so alive because you're just inches from death. And it made life grand and exciting in a way that I had never experienced before in my life. But also you begin to like start to lose pieces of your soul while you're out there. In writing the book, and this is because there's stuff I want to talk about, obviously, you know, from the ambush that really kind of flipped a switch for me. But the most challenging aspect about writing my experience as a war veteran was reliving a lot of those traumatic moments. There were just times where I would be writing and I pushed stuff so far down. And like my wife, she didn't know any of my stories. Most of my friends knew nothing about my story. They just knew that I had served overseas. I was an Iraq and Afghan war veteran, and I had some awards, and that was it. And most of my awards, you can see them behind me now. Most of them.
That's pretty sick placard there.
My wife got it for me because I had put all my stuff in a box underneath my bed.
No, man, that's.
And that's what we do. I was just like, I'm just going to get on with my life or whatever. So when I start reliving this, the trauma resurfaces. And there are just times, you know, where my wife would just find me crying. She's like, what is wrong? You know? And I'm having to write about these experiences that I have pushed down so far. And, you know, and because I want the book to be true, and I want it to be as brutal and as vulnerable as possible, because the reason why I wrote it the way that I did, and the challenging aspect of writing it that way, was that everybody else were Navy SEALs that had written books, and that's fine, you know, but they're writing about the jingoistic, what I like to call war porn a lot of times, where it's like, yep, I did this, and, you know, I shot these people, and, you know, yay America. And I was like, what happens when you come home and you want to kill yourself because of what you did overseas? How do I explain that? How do I explain the things that I did that are going to make me look like a monster, and everybody not think that I'm a monster? And that was a really challenging aspect to it all. So
I think you came out very human, especially when you're talking about some experiences you saw in Afghanistan. I think the biggest thing that got me not putting the book down was that I kind of felt like if I actually ever got the balls to do something like that, like you're talking, you got to kill the coward, you know, it's a fight or flight kind of thing. That the way you kind of went through and how you talked about like the downtime and, you know, getting the balls to get up and do stuff and then going home and dealing with the trauma, it felt very human. And it would be something that I think with you talking about, it would probably hit a lot of points with other veterans or other people who experience other types of trauma, not just war trauma, right? It's
Right.
It's talking about it and making it feel human. And you did a great job of doing that. That's what I liked.
Yeah. I had a friend who was a victim of sex trafficking, sadly. And she read my book and she was like, oh my gosh, this totally hit home. And she's never served. But there was this moment when I was in Afghanistan, it was called the Bermel Massacre, is what called it. And what had happened is that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had teamed up, and there was this small village called Bermel, and they went in and massacred everyone. And when I say massacre, they massacred them, decapitated people, threw grenades in homes to where, you know, it's just body parts, organs are strewn in the street. Here's the crazy part. I can't remember a damn thing about that day, even though I wrote about it in my journal. I have like this weird foggy memory where I like pulled a human tooth out of the wall. Ugh. And what's funny is like, I didn't even remember Gonzo was there. I thought I was there by myself. And when I wrote about it, he was like, and he was fact checking, you know, his portion and his, you know, adaptation of himself in the book. He's like, "Hey man, I was at Bermel too." And I was like, "You were?" And he was like, "Yeah, it was fucked up." And I was like, "Okay." But what happens is, and I later learned about this in my, you know, certifications and studies into mental health, is when the mind goes through something that traumatic, it'll do stuff to protect it. So it'll just like, it's like,
block it.
Didn't happen. Just block. It's like, block. You're not going to think about this stuff. Otherwise you're going to go crazy and insane. Mm. And so that's what it did. And then, you know, when you get into counseling years later, all these memories start to resurface and you're just like, ah! And so out of that, you know, it was just, yeah.
Well, you kept your composure and wrote the book and it came out perfect. So good on you.
Did it end up by being therapeutic at all for you to, at
the end of the day,
to kind of get it on paper and, you know, I haven't read it yet. I'm not a big reader for pleasure. Cause I do so much, well, I used to do so much garbage reading for work, but you know, this is something that I'm, you know, the boys have told me a couple of stories that kind of raised the hair on the back of my neck that I'm a little bit nervous to read some of the shit that you've seen.
Dog strikes one.
Just something about little kids or something like that. And
yeah, well, anyways, I'll tell a story from the book. I'll tell two stories from the book real quick. And I think this'll tie it all together. So there's this like moment that changed forever who I was. We had gone on this large scale clearing operation. And I'm in Afghanistan at the time. And, we go around, we're traveling through these dry creek beds called wadis, right? And we would do this thing called clear by fire. And it's where you come around a blind corner. A lot of times the Taliban and Al-Qaeda would strategically place themselves on top of a ridge line. So when you came around blind, they would just rain down, you know, hell on you. And so a lot of times the clear by fire, we would shoot over it to see if like, you know, like they would start taking pop shots early on. So we knew an ambush was set up. Well, we didn't do that day. So the front of the convoy goes around the corner, they get attacked. I'm on the back end around the corner already, and I can see up on this ridge line where the fire is coming down from. And so it's like me and my guys, you know, we're up there and we're firing, but we have no shots. Everything's obstructed. We're just shooting at nothing. And so they tell us to cease fire, you know, save your ammunition. So I'm literally sitting there in this position while the people at the front are getting shot at, feeling stupid and useless. And then they call for the mortar team. Well, we're with the mortar team. I am not a mortar man, mind you. But they need help because half of their guys are up at the front. We're in the back half. And they're like, "Hey, help us out." And then so my team sergeant, Gonzo, he yells at me. And he was like, "Hey, help us unload the tubes." So we unload the tubes, hammer them down. You know, they're the green tubes that you see where you drop the and then move. And so they show us what to do. So that, you know, we're doing that. And when I'm like, "Hey man, can I shoot these? I would love to do it." And they're like, "Yeah, get some," which is weird. They probably shouldn't have, but they did. And it was awesome. So all of a sudden I'm in the middle of combat now, and I am shooting mortars and rockets up at this ridgeline, and shit is exploding everywhere. And I'm like, "This is fucking sick. I love this," you know? And I'm on an absolute adrenaline, just high at this point. And you know, they're getting shellacked. Luckily, we have an Air Force enlisted tactical air controller with us. Those are the people that call in, you know, the jets, the Apaches, the whole nine yards. They're like, hey, we're getting shellacked. We have an Apache on standby. The Apache shows up, and that, to tell you, this is the most terrifying thing you'll ever see in your entire life. They have a 30 millimeter chain gun that just rips up the sides of everything, Hellfire missiles. You can literally run or die. That's it. And you're probably going to die. So it comes up from behind this mountain, and they're like, all right, ceasefire. Apache's here. Everybody stops, and you just watch it like, like just ash and rubble. And I'm like, good night. So after the firefight's over, I trudge up this hill, and we have our interpreter. You know, we're the cultural experts. There's this home on top. It's got this, you know, smoke coming out of the top. I remember that.
Oh my God. I remember the story.
Old man with a red bottom stained beard, cultural practice. And he wants to know about his teenage son. And he's like screaming as he's being detained and yelling. They call for me and the interpreter. And I was like, well, where's his son? Like, you know, he shouldn't have been. And he was like, well, he was up at the ridgeline shooting at y'all. And I was like, uh-oh. And the old man points to exactly where we've been dumping mortars, you know? And I'm like, oh, shit. So I walk away, and, you know, I feel super alive at this point. I remember, like, what the sky looks like. I remember that smoke coming out of the thing. I remember what the gravel and the pebbles on the ground. I can still see it all, you know, in my mind's eye right now. And this other soldier walks up to me, and he's like, hey, his son's dead. And I was like, well, how do you know? And he said, well, you guys were dumping mortars there. And he goes, I was firing a Mark 19, which is an automatic grenade launcher in that area. And he's like, and then the Apache. And he's like, I went back there and checked, and there's nothing left, man. And I was like, all right. So I tell the interpreter, I'm like, hey, you need to tell him his son's dead. And so he does. And that dude just crumbles, and he lets out this shriek, this wail. That sounds like a wounded animal, you know? And like, it sticks with you. And, you know, I trudge back down the mountain. We go back to our base, and I write about, you know, in my journal, and I don't think anything of it. You know, I remember writing like, the sledge that everybody knew back home is dead, and I don't think he's ever coming back. And when I came home as a very different person, and war will do that to you. And so, years later, we're getting ready to deploy to Iraq. And this guy walks up to me, and he's in the book. His name's Kit McVeigh. He's a young private at this point. Mm-hmm. He's coming with us, and he goes, hey, Gonzo said you guys got to actually launch mortars while you're in combat. Is that true? And I was like, yeah, man. I was like, we did. It was crazy. And without knowing it, the memory of the firefight comes back, and I start thinking about everything. And, you know, it's like a firing squad, but I'm like, did I kill a kid? Did I kill some 13-year-old teenager? And I start to spiral, you know? And I'm like, I can't think about this. We're going to war. Screw them. Whatever. So I don't think anything. You know, I block that part until I have to deal with it for years later. And then I end up in Ramadi, Iraq during the surge. So from 2006 to 2007, Ramadi, Iraq is the most violent city on earth. From 2006 to 2007, it accounted for half of all daily attacks that happened in the country of Iraq. So think about that. You know, there's Baghdad, there's Basra, there's Tikrit, all these places. They have different attacks going on throughout the day. Half of every single attack that is happening in that country is coming out of the place where I'm at. Then on top of that, half of all deaths for the United States Marine Corps from 2006 to 2007, half of all of them occur in Ramadi. So
when you're heading in.
Yeah. So I walk in, and everyone's like, we call it the meat grinder because it just chews you up and spits you out. And so I end up Christmas.
That's tough.
Christmas Day. Well, Christmas Eve, you know, we're getting find out. And this is a few days before Christmas. Find out we're going to retake the city and go on this massive clearing operation. We got to end the violent insurgency that's going on there. So this Marine Expeditionary Unit comes in and I meet up with this guy named Major Scott Husing. We're actually really good friends now. He's actually an author too. He wrote a book called Echo and Ramadi. Nice. So we call each other one another now. And we're like, this is wild, man. Like, but great dude, great leader, great Marine. So he's asking us like all types of questions. He's like, you know, what's the city? How's it permissive? Like, what are choke points? X, Y, Z. Cause we had been there for a while at this point. Mm-hmm. And we know we're about to walk into the hornet's nest. And so he listens. And I think because of that, he saved a lot of his men's life to be straight. He lost a few while we were out there, but I think overall he did such a phenomenal job of leading. But so I'm pouring over maps on like Christmas Day and all types of crazy stuff. And then we go on this clearing operation called Operation Kazarine. We're going to retake this one section of the city while another Marine Expeditionary Unit takes over another part of the city. The SEAL team is going to take Corregidor. And that's when Jocko Willink and like Chris Kyle and their team are there. So we're all in this together, you know? And so we start the clearing operation, and on Christmas Day, I mean, technically it was December 26th, but it's like midnight of Christmas Day, I walk out the front gate of Camp Ramadi with a Marine Expeditionary Unit, and eventually like all hell breaks loose, of course, because you have a huge presence of soldiers walking the streets in the middle of an urban conflict. So we take over houses, and eventually we had taken over certain aspects of houses and created these combat outposts to control strategic points in the city. And we end up on this road called Millions. And it's called Millions. It was technically named after a porn star, but which is what, yeah, all of our roads were named after porn stars or like
fair enough.
Hot actresses. So we had like Lopez was a street, you know, named after J-Lo. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just wild. We actually had a street called Bacalacadaca Street though, from Team America. And that,
yeah,
that was always funny. Cause you would hear somebody come over the radio and be like, we have two military age males going east on Bacalacadaca Street. I'd be like, get the fuck out of here.
Durka, Muhammad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we're on this road called Millions.
Crazy ass fucking
Millions movie. Is because there's a million IEDs on it. It's permanently black. And if a black road means it's non-permissive, you cannot travel it. Just because of IEDs or threat of ambush. This one's permanent. Like for a year, it has been black. You do not travel it. The Marines are like, let's go down this road. I'm like, this is a really bad idea. All of a sudden, we start seeing that, you know, they're setting up for an ambush. We alert the Marine Lieutenant. They call into Cop Steel, which is the combat outpost near us that 1st Infantry Division is running. They're like, get the F off that street. You're going to die. They're like, rally point back here. We have troops in contact across the way. Well, the troops in contact across the way, I figure, are my guys. So my team, my four-man civil affairs team, Alpha, had split up. I'm with me and my lieutenant, and then my other buddy Wagner and Starnes, they're with another Marine Expeditionary Unit. We get to Cop Steel. I go to the rooftop and I just see these smoke plumes billowing in the distance. And the first sergeant of the base is like, hey, are you guys with that other platoon? And I was like, yeah. And he said, well, we got troops in contact right now. And I don't know their status. And I was like, shit. Well, all of a sudden we start taking fire on the rooftop and this mosque goes crazy and it starts riling up all the locals, like, you know, kill the infidels, like kind of stuff like that. So we start taking shots. We've got the snipers on the roof. I start shooting down this alleyway near the mosque. The first sergeant, he's got a high powered scope on his M16, his M4. And, you know, he's shooting and he stops and he's like, hold on, ceasefire. And he's like, hey, man, take a look, because I'm running a red dot EOTech, which is for close quarters combat. So you can, you know, get shots off quickly. And I look down this alleyway and there's this little girl. She's about 6 years old. She's in a yellow dress, waddling, and she's holding munitions. Right. And
she's holding rounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like explosives and shit like that. And that's what they would do. Like the insurgents were really cruel. They knew that, and they would do this. They would have kids like throw out, we call them pizza box IEDs. And they were pressure reactive, and they looked like pizza boxes, but they had explosives. And so the charge would connect and then explode, and they could just hurl them out, and you would see them do it, and they would use kids. So you either shot a kid or you didn't. And so they were doing the same thing. So she's walking to where the smoke plumes are headed. And like my heart sinks because I know her too. We called her the flower girl. She's the sweet little girl, black hair, you know, dirty all the time, always in this yellow dress. She didn't know what she's doing. And she would come by the combat outpost to like give us all flowers. She would always give us little yellow daisies. And I had her little yellow daisy in my chest rig. And, you know, we would give her hugs and chocolate and stuff like that. And the first sergeant just goes, I mean, you can shoot her technically. She's an enemy combatant now. And I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? And like, you know, that moment from the firefight in Afghanistan comes back and I'm like, is this the type of person I am? What type of person am I going to be? This will haunt me forever. You know, well, what if Starnes and Wegner die? This will be your fault. Like, it's like, you know, the angel and the demon on the shoulder.
Oh, just so much going through your coconut, man, within a split second.
So, eventually I hand him back the rifle and I don't even say anything. I can't even formulate the words. And he's like, hey man, you made the right choice. He's like, we make choices here every day that are life or death. And you made the right one. He's like, we're Americans. We don't shoot kids. And I knew that technically wasn't true because like some of my friends who were snipers had kids rush them with AKs or
sometimes so you have so to. Forth.
Yeah. But it was my team was fighting for their life, Starnes and Wegner. It was two of them versus like 20 insurgents on a rooftop. And until the Marines backed them up, it was those two by themselves taking on just a huge thing. And she walked over there and probably reinforced them too. I don't know. I can speculate at this point. But, you know, it was moments.
Not.
Yeah, it's moments like that, though, that I think a lot of the civilian populace didn't understand the complexities of what we were forced to deal with overseas.
And even if you tell them, Sledge, I don't think that they can, most people can't comprehend, right?
Yeah. And so I don't, you know, it was stuff like that that you deal with. Where, you know, you begin to believe the worst about yourself as far as a human, because, that's actually the term that I've discovered in my own, you know, coursework, because it was like, you know, I came back and they're like, oh, you have classic PTSD kind of thing. I'm like, yeah. And I would get better, but I would think about those moments with like the kids or people dying or somebody's guts being strewn out or their head being blown in. And there were these moments too, where, you know, you had to photograph the bodies for reports and everything. And we had this battle called Donkey Island where like 100 suicide, 100, insurgents with like suicide vests went there and most of them detonated themselves. And you're taking photos of that and there's just guts torn out everywhere. And I would keep these photos and I would find myself like waking up at like 3 a.m. because I couldn't sleep. And I would just go to my computer and I'd open that file and just stare at dead bodies. Yep. And I couldn't figure out why I was doing it. And so years later, there was a term that we discovered because they started calling it resistant treatment post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was like, this post-traumatic stress is a traumatic. You operate out of a traumatic stressor. So like, great. Mm-hmm. For instance, for me, I didn't do fireworks for a real long time because of the simple fact that it sounded like incoming artillery, that the whistle and the whoosh. I was like, can't do this. You know, just it caused me to go right back to where I was.
But going back to the source, you're going back to the source in this instance, right?
Right. So what I discovered is it's called moral injury. And that's the psychological damage that occurs to your psyche when you have to do things that violate your sense of right and wrong. You know, dead bodies, shooting a woman or child, killing another human. And you live with that and your brain, because say what you will, all of us know that inherently, though we cannot prove this, we cannot empirically prove this, we know that human life, for whatever reason, is sacred. Like, most of us know that the most mentally handicapped child has more inherent value and worth than a prize-winning horse, right? But you can't prove that. You scientifically can't prove that, and yet we know that. And so when you're forced to do something like that, like taking a life, it just...
The soul, right?
Yeah. The soul. It's a, so they call it soul wounds.
So I've got one more question, if you don't mind me asking. So wasted time games... thanks for always watching. Asked a question, which was, what inspired you to write the book? And what do you hope readers take away from it?
So this will kind of go on to what Talking Animal said too. What inspired me to write the book is I felt that the modern day veteran story was not being told.
That's spot on. Wow, that's good for you. That's great.
Yeah. And I had talked with so many veterans. They're like, yeah, it's cool. Like, and I was on Marcus Luttrell's podcast. Marcus Luttrell, awesome, phenomenal dude. Love that guy. Navy Cross recipient, Operation Red Wings, Lone Survivor became a movie, the whole nine yards. But his experience was this one battle as far as everything. And Marcus was actually in Ramadi the same time as I was. So he knows the hell that they went through. And I think he's got another book in him at least to write about. That, but most of it, what publishers were looking for, and this is not to the detriment of these authors at all, what publishers were looking for were those classic war stories, yeah. Where like Chris Kyle, American Sniper, Marcus Luttrell, Lone Survivor, you've got The Operator, which is Robert O'Neill, and all these dudes were SEALs. So there's a tier one level operators, right? Green Berets, the whole nine yards. These guys are specialized of specialized of specialized. What about the other 99% of us that were just grunts trying to do our job? And then we come home to a world that doesn't feel like home anymore. Hmm. And so all of us really felt alienated. We felt like our story was not being told. And I never felt like my story was told. And I was like, what would it look like if I wrote the story of the average guy or girl that, got plucked out of their happy-go-lucky home life, and then comes home a disaster when they get back. And then how do I encourage people to confront the bullshit that we dealt with and embrace healing? And that's really what inspired me and what I want people to take away from. I have two goals. One, I want the veteran to feel like their voice. They finally have a voice and they go, if you want to know what I went through, read this. And then two, I wanted the civilian populace to understand what the past 20 years of war did to us psychologically and emotionally.
Sledge, how many people do you think go to war and don't come back with PTSD or some form of trauma?
It really depends.
I don't know anybody that could. I genuinely, maybe people could store it deeper or further back or don't address it. But I've never come across a human being that could witness some of the accounts that you've told us about and come back the same person.
Yeah.
Come back undamaged, right?
Gonzo seems to be one of those guys, but like I said, he's got ice in his veins and he did way more heroic, insane stuff than me. Like that dude is a living legend in the United States Army. Just absolutely so many valor awards. It's nuts. Like he's such, that dude.
Does he ever come talk to any of your support groups or anything like that? Or does he just... No.
Gonzo is also still serving in the military. And so there's kind of that faux pas of mental health and stuff. And plus, like he's always told me, he was like, war was just something I inherently understood. And I was good at it. And I don't have any regrets. And I'm just like, that works for him. And he's not a He's not a psychopath. He's not a
sociopath. No, he's not an asshole or anything. That's just his.
No. He's a very kind, very generous, very talented human being. But, you know, I think also, too, when you're still serving, you're kind of still in that warrior mindset. So it's a little bit easier to compartmentalize. What happens, though, is when you finally leave the military. That's when I see people struggle. And the reality is there's this 2012 study by Gibbons and colleagues that showcases this. They discovered that veterans who leave the military, if they don't find a new unit, tribe, faith affiliation, or something to identify with, they'll struggle the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Now, I'm just trying to, I'm just digesting everything you're saying as well after reading the book. Like, I'm just kind of, you know, you're right. I think while you're in it, the only thing that I can relate to and that I can bridge this gap in, and under no circumstances am I even putting this as the same. It's like, you're professional athletes, right? They, you know, that band of brotherhood, that brand of womanhood, that you're in that locker room every day practicing. And then the minute that they leave, that's when everything just crumbles apart, right? They just don't understand how to get out of, you know, that's when they have to face reality. And is that what you think maybe why Gonzo's still able to do what he's doing? Or is it because, do you find, I guess, you obviously had to what Bondo said, like you had to have been able to compartmentalize.
I think mental health, that? But I think mental health is a weakness on the battlefield, right?
It's an oxymoron in the middle or in the military, like
right.
But if you're because it's weak, and I'm not saying it. Look at I'm not saying it. I'm not saying with malice. No ill intent at all for anybody. I've got loved ones. I deal with mental health issues myself, loved ones. But I think when you're going to war, if you're worried about your head, I mean, you got to be worried more so about a bigger purpose, right? Like, you know what I mean?
That's a great point. So here's something interesting that I bring up. Notice that when we go to war, none of us have post-traumatic stress. It's when we get home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's with that?
Right.
Well, it's because we're focused. We're on a job. We care about the guy or the girl next to us. We want to make it home. We don't have time to think about that stuff.
We got a warrior hat on, right?
Like, when you take the other hat off, though, and you go home, and you're supposed to like reintegrate into civilian society.
Well, I think the big thing, though, when you're in war, if you do let people down, you're letting down your teammate, more or less, right? And you can't do that. So when you're home by yourself, you no longer have that teammate that's relying on you to stay alive. So now, you know, that power that you get to make sure you don't let someone down is no longer there. And then you don't have that teammate back with you, you know? So it's, you have to be stronger at war, I think. And you can let yourself down a bit when you come home, unfortunately, right? And that might be why some people have that letdown.
I would imagine, and you can talk, Sledge, but the only thing that would matter when you're in war is live or die.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And it makes life grand. It makes everything so simple. But here's what's interesting, and I bring this up a lot right now. I train different entities and organizations here in the state of Colorado with regard to everything from hiring veterans to how do we reach homeless veterans to so I've worked with like Colorado State University, Volunteers of America. They ask a lot. And I said, well, there's a misnomer that's happening right now as far as our data. So do you know who the largest demographic that is dying by suicide is right now out of our veterans?
No.
Vietnam veterans.
Yeah, really, eh? That mm-hmm. vintage?
Yeah, so are the average of seven.
That makes a lot of sense, though.
So here's why. And we're doing the same thing. So years later from now, we're going to see the same thing happen. A friend of
mine. Hopefully not, because you're going to inform them.
Yeah.
Right?
The So when everyone's like, oh, you know, it's the 22 a day, what they're really talking about is like, it's a lot of Vietnam veterans that are dying by suicide. Now, granted, there's a large percentage of GWAT veterans, Iraq, Afghanistan. And when I say GWAT, that means Global War on Terror. And then also you have those that just were in the military and couldn't cope and everything else that never saw combat. But the thing that we're discovering and that I've discovered, and this is somewhat of a theory. I think it's true. I think the data will support this, is that when I got home, and like you said, you know, like what inspired you to write this book? Why did it take so long? XYZ. I was like, I'm going to get busy living and I'm going to do work and screw thinking about this stuff. I'm never going to think about it. I'm going to put all my medals into a box. I'm going to put all my military stuff. And that was a part of my life then. I'm not going to deal with it now. I'm going to do like what my grandfather did. We just don't talk about it. The end.
Chapter closed.
Yeah, chapter closed. And so I was like, I'm going to get to work, get into work, 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 work. And so that's what I did. I joined a geopolitical intelligence firm. It was great. That's how I met Peter Zion, who you guys have you know, talked about as far as everything from his books. We still work together. Yeah. Great friend, really close buddy of mine. And he actually endorsed my book. Because, you know, he loves stuff from the geopolitical aspect. So he got to see it from the war side, but, went to work in that company and I went to work, did my job, kind of thing. Years later, I met this guy named Matt. He'd also been wounded in action. And he started working for really large companies on the West Coast, ranging from like Instagram to doing like social media. And he, one day somebody took notice on like one of his social media profiles that he had a Marine Corps thing in the background, and they asked him about it, and he opened up and all his trauma came flooding back and he just fell apart. And kind of the same thing happened to me. I'm not going to spoil it. But the you guys who've read the book,
yep.
I start interacting with the priest and, while I'm in Iraq, and he just really provides some comfort and solace. And then years later, I come home, discover some information, and that's when everything in my life started falling apart. And I was, you know, my wife was like, you got to get back in counseling. Things are messed up. Like, you know, I start doing EMDR therapy in 2019 and 2020. Just because it's just, devastating.
Vesuvius erupted.
Yeah. So here's the point. Here's why Vietnam veterans in mass are doing this. And if you look, and again, I go back to Carl Marlantis, who phenomenal author, Marine Corps, Vietnam veteran, Navy Cross recipient, which is the second highest award that you can receive next to the Medal of Honor. And, you know, he writes about this in like his own book. He had literally done the same thing that I did. And I didn't read his book until I'm going through like, you know, my EMDR therapy, and I'm crying half the time I'm reading this book. Cause I'm like, oh my God, it's me. It's me. Oh my God, it's me. Yeah. And so he went home after Vietnam, didn't talk about Vietnam, went to work, started building his companies, the whole nine yards. His wife notices there are some things that are off, the way that he treats the kids, you know, X, Y, Z. So she encourages him to do this counseling thing. And he comes back to this memory of when he has to kill this young Vietnamese kid. And he spirals and everything comes back and he's just a mess for like a decade. And then, you know, he finally writes his book when he's in his like 60s, 70s now. You know, and it leads to divorce for him, like a lot of issues, a lot of mental health struggles, the whole nine yards. And here's what's happened is we come home, we compartmentalize and we go, I'm going to get on with living. And we're good. We're good for 5 years, a year, 10 years for me. And then something triggers that. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff that's buried, that's gotten gangrenous.
Never dealt with, right?
Never dealt with. So here's what's happening. All the Vietnam vets are boomers and they're all retiring. They have nothing but time and thought on their hands. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to come back to the surface?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You're definitely going to dig deep, right?
Now, just a little bit of a break. Anyone that's just tuned in or listening, again, Amazon.ca, Where Cowards Go to Die. Great book. Please go buy.
I love Canadians. You guys want a bet?
$35 Canadian for a hardcover. You can also do the Kindle or the ebook. And you said that people Audible. Really like the ebook. The Audible.
Everybody loves Audible. The narrated version is done by Bradford Hastings, who's an award-winning voice actor, and he's done Marvel and Star Wars. So people have just gone absolutely gangbusters over it because he does such a great job. My only complaint is he makes all of us sound like we're Southern and hick. Some of these guys are like from the Northeast. I'm like, why? Because I'm from Oklahoma. You're just like, yeah, let's just do it.
Not anymore.
Yeah. I did want to say one thing about Canadians because this is fun. A couple years ago, I was in Ottawa, Canada, and I'm up there, and I go to a pub for a pint, right? And I'm watching the news, and you know the number one thing that the Canadians were outraged about?
What? Beavertail?
People were price gouging on hockey tickets. Prices. Yeah. And that was like the number one headline, and I was like,
for sure.
I was like, dude, Canadians are awesome. I was like,
you should have seen when Gord Downie was doing his last tour for the Tragically Hip. And then that's when really that was at the very beginning of the Ticketmaster fiasco. And we couldn't, like, diehard fans of the Hip could not get tickets to go see the last, because we knew he was dying. We knew Gord was dying and he had glioblastoma. So we were outraged, like just outraged. You touch our hockey and our hip.
You should see when the maple syrup prices inflate. It's gangbusters down here. People are losing their mind.
So
we're burning cars over here. It's
I was like, Timmy's. These people are awesome. I was like, everybody else in America is outraged over really dumb stuff. Like yours is, I was like, they're just mad about hockey. I was like, that makes sense. Whereas, like, you know, we had like Donald Trump and everything else going on, and everyone like was like trying to kill each other, and you know, we got school shooting. I was like, good God. I was like, I'm moving to Canada.
The Toronto Maple Leafs don't play on Saturday night. It's a national uproar. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's and so good, I made sure I ordered some Canadian poutine too.
That'll stop your heart. So that'll stop your
can
heart.
Can we
delicious though? Delicious.
Without getting into the book, Rookie, can we go to the five if we could? If you don't mind. Thank you. Sledge, can we talk about or briefly touch on, because this is a big integral piece of the book, and it happened to my buddy JJ. He was in the 86th Airborne Division. Sledge, because you wrote him a book.
Oh, wait, your buddy JJ? No, he's with 173rd Airborne.
173rd Airborne, thank you. You guys say these numbers, and I can't, you know what I mean? He was a paratrooper in Afghanistan, did one tour. Brief definition, he told me, depending on the role, is what you guys consider a tour. Typically, it's a year, but you've done... Can you explain it maybe? Because I probably got it wrong and JJ is going to kill me later. It is what
depending on what branch of the service you're in will determine how long you're overseas for. So Marines typically do 6-month rotations. So if you're a Marine Corps and you have 4 tours, you did 2 years. Now the
That's
Army,
what he said. Okay.
The Army will do very long tours. The thing, so when I was in Ramadi, I did a 15-month tour. That's a year and 3 months. And then I did 9 months in Afghanistan. That's 2 years. So while I did 2 tours, as far as like Army standards, I've technically done 4 tours, you know, with regard to, the Marine Corps. The Air Force is even shorter. Theirs are 3 to 6 month deployments. Because the Air Force actually treats people the best. The Navy is somewhere around 6 to 9 months too, just depending. So a lot of it just depends. And then your tier one guys, and when I say tier one, that's all your like super special operations guys, your Navy SEALs, your Delta Force, 160th Special Operations Aviation and Rescue. They're typically 6 months, and they'll do 6 months on over there, or they might do 3 months and they're home for like a month or 3 months, and their operational tempo is just crazy. So a lot of it just depends on the service, but the Army typically, because we're the largest branch, had the longest tours. And it was simply because of the fact that we did not have a draft. So think about that. In World War II, you had 11% of the population serve, in 4 years of war. So, and that was all men. In Vietnam, you had 7% of the population serve, there was a draft. Makes sense, right? And so people would do their year or 2 years, and then they would go home. 20 years of war. 20 years of war. That is insane.
That is insane.
0.86%. 0.86% of the population, and we were sent on repeated back to back to back. There's all these studies that show you should never do more than, like, you know, 2 years or anything, period. And they were just like, ah, screw them, man. Like, they're already effed, so just keep sending them.
Oh, and Jesus.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
And they're like, why are our veterans so screwed? I was like, I don't know. 20 years of war will do that. And I couldn't even get out of the military. They had this thing called stop loss. So even though they didn't have a draft, they had a draft for those of us that were already in. And so literally they were like, even if you want to leave the military, you cannot, because you're a highly specialized skill and therefore you're not allowed to get out. And they're like, but you can reenlist for another 3 years and we'll give you money. So it's like, well, if I can't get out, well, all right, I guess I'll reenlist again. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. So they institutionalized us and there was no draft, and the American populace and the rest of the world largely got to check out the lunch. And everyone goes, well, okay. The thing that I tell people now is the American populace at general, you know, what freedom did we protect for them? We gave them the freedom of not having a draft. They got to check out for 20 years. They didn't have to deal with dead bodies coming home on the news. We just kind of, the national interest is like, man, whatever. Yeah, there's a war, but what? Who cares?
First couple of years, hey, Ben? Like, they were, you know, it was hot topic. And then after that, nothing.
Well, and that's why there was this great, and Sledge, you and I were having a chat before, and, you know, I watched that great Monk debate, which is, you know, can you trust the modern media?
No.
It was a great, and you can't, because
and I'm a journalist.
It doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't fit the narrative you don't hear. So we know full well, I don't know if it appeared on opensecrets.com, but I definitely found it. It was reported that basically under the Bush and Obama administrations, right at the end of the Bush administration, beginning of the Obama administration, they prevented news programs, both Fox and MSNBC and CNN, et cetera, from showing the caskets coming home, because it didn't fit the government's narrative. Because politicians are just a bunch of assholes.
Look at what's going on right now. Russia and Ukraine. Everybody was talking about it at the beginning.
Yep.
Now you barely hear anything about it anymore.
You're
right?
Still hearing a little bit, but in another 6 months,
we're doing nothing. Work. Yeah, we're doing work over there. We've got all of our guys over in Poland. We got our special forces guys going into Ukraine and training them. We're bringing the Ukrainians out to different military installations here to train them.
You're not active anymore, Ray Sledge, are you?
No, but I keep my ear close. I live right on the footsteps of Fort Carson, and so I'm friends with like a lot of the guys that are. Just
shit,
and then
shit seems like it's going down here, right?
Okay, well, can I ask it? Like, can we talk about? Well, and it could be a no, and because maybe it's the part of the book, and maybe you don't want to go there. So, just can we talk about April?
Yeah, because I don't want to get sued. April.
That's right. Yeah. And just the family, and could you talk about it in the book? And that's not what I'm trying to get at. And I'm just saying, like, the lack of support that the Army and the Navy and the would provide the families back at home, and counseling and how to, you know what I mean? And we cannot, and that's fine. But I just want maybe to touch on that, the lack of.
Yeah.
Did your
government take care of you well coming back to their country after having fought for them, right?
Okay. So people ask me that question all the time. And I go, you want to know how well we're treating our veterans? Go down to your local VA office. How are we doing?
Veteran Affairs. Right.
No, it's a shit show. Like, it has the worst reputation out of any institution. So let me give you guys this. I just had surgery this last week, right?
You told me about that. Yeah.
Throughout here. So this is fun. So Oh my God. I'm going to get on a
tell them why. Tell them why you did.
So while we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, we had these things called burn pits. Burn pits were basically, they were like, look, there's a lot of sensitive information that we don't want the Taliban or Al-Qaeda getting their hands on because we're fighting, you know, an advanced enemy, blah, 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 blah. So we would just burn everything, cardboard, lithium batteries, our feces, and we burned it all with jet fuel. That's got to be healthy. And then slept next to it and inhaled it all. So a lot of us are coming back with cancer clusters, cancer just in weird places. I've had friends in my unit. I'm not going to spoil things for the book that are dead now, because of certain types of cancer that they got. So, come to find out, like years later, I start having issues, and I'm like, dude, like I can't breathe. You know, I'm constantly messed up here. And then all this stuff about the burn pits comes up, and I literally slept right next to one. I was always burning our feces. I have photos of the stuff, you know? I'm like, oh, this is funny. I'm glad I documented it now. So I come in and I have to have surgery on my sinus cavity. They do 8 different procedures.
Jesus, Murphy.
Yeah. So because I have allergic rhinitis, chronic acute severe recurrent sinusitis, sinus disease, a deviated septum. And that was from when I went head first in the wall when I got wounded in combat. When they attacked our base, which I didn't talk about that's funny. We can talk about that in a minute. Everyone loves that story. So I've told it like 80,000 times, but, so it was just really bad stuff going on there. And finally I complained about it enough that they send me to a specialist. So the VA contracts now with like specialties. So I go to an ear, nose and throat specialist, and this dude takes one look at me and he goes, you are all types of effed up. You have to have surgery. And I was like, I figured that's the case. Okay, so I have this severe sinus disease, and so they start clearing it up. And he's like, look, man, you're still going to deal with this stuff for the rest of your life. I'm sorry. He's like, we do what we can. He said, but when I got in there, it was a absolute disaster. He was like, it's crazy. I've never seen stuff like this. I was like, sweet.
Yeah, perfect. That's exactly what I want to hear, right?
Yeah. So the VA is like, the VA passed this thing called the PACT Act. Or Congress did, and it's supposed to take care of our veterans that were exposed to this and compensate them monetarily and with medical services to take care of our veterans. Yay. So they tell us to file. So I file, right? I've got it right here. I'll show you this stuff. So here's my letter. They go, yep, we did it. We effed you up. You're service rated. It says, yes, is it service connected? At 0%, you get nothing.
That's pretty nice.
So, and then on top of that, I have a cervical neck injury because I went headfirst into a wall. They denied that too. So now I'm having to, I literally have to have a lawyer now. One of my friends is drafting up legal document. I pulled all my medical records from the military, and I specifically it shows I have a neck injury from the day that I got wounded in combat. I'm having to send in my orders for my Purple Heart to show them neck injury, head first, into the wall, traumatic brain injury, concussion. And then on top of that, I'm having to gather sworn statements from Gonzo, who's an EMT and a paramedic with the Wichita Fire Department. And then on top of that was a combat medic before he moved over to us to write a sworn statement being like, I examined him. Like,
wow, that's a big fuck you from, oh my God. Yeah. That sucks.
So that's how well we're taking care of our veterans.
Thanks again, politicians. Just to let you know, politicians, thank you. Yeah. You guys are great. Yeah. You're wonderful people.
You guys are great. Thank you for,
Yeah, and thanks for, you know what just drives me, I can't stand when I cannot stand when a politician says they've served your country. No, you didn't. You worked for the Corporation of Canada, you worked for the Corporation of Ontario, you worked for the Corporation of your region or your city. Oh, you did not
they're
serve.
They're working for the corporations, Facebook, Google, that's it. All the monopolies now.
Some you of them may have jack served. Shit. Some of them may have served.
Some,
well.
There's a some.
Few, and Pete Buttigieg, like he's the Navy vet and he's like, I'm a combat. I'm like, you're not a combat vet. What are you
did administrative.
Combat? Like you're an administrative pogue. And a pogue is a person other than grunt. Now, granted, this is not to take away anybody's service as far as everything.
No, not at all. That's not what we're saying.
But at the end of the day, I don't want their account in terms of dealing with traumatic experiences and what it's actually like to fucking be in war. If you're in an office, right? I can do that in my law office.
The reality of the situation that most people have to realize is like the term combat veteran is very interesting and convoluted. So there are people who sat on base and never left base and got to eat frozen ice cream and Red Bull slushies. I'm not kidding you. There were Red Bull slushies in the green zone. It was insane.
Jack them right up, eh?
Yeah. So they got to live it. They didn't have to see combat. And that's just the reality of the military because most of them are combat multipliers. And the percentage that actually do see combat are more. I get upset when you have these guys that went overseas, like Pete, who really try to play up their, like, I was, you know, I was this
look
dude
what I
that
did.
Went over there and look what I did. And I'm like, man, like, you know that when you start going down that road, the rest of us veterans are like, you punk bitch, you know?
Yeah.
We know what's up. We knew you were 100%. A father.
Yeah. So. Yeah. 100%. 100%. Poser, right?
You don't open up the book that way, but very close to the very beginning of the book, you talk about the attack on base after you get to Organy.
Organy, Afghanistan.
Can you All right. Let's, because that is a kind of, I know, not the fact that you got hurt or it was traumatic, and that's what you kind of go down this whole path of the PTSD and because of that. But if you want to talk about it.
When are we running to, Brand? Curry, what are we running to, one? Are we running to one?
Well, it's really up to Sledge. I mean.
Yeah. You guys got time. Okay. Keep going.
Well, I want him to leave the audience with a hook, right? So that they. You know what I mean? So I'm just not sure on the timing if the, you know what I mean.
This whole episode's been a hook. I don't know how you don't.
No, 100%. After listening to this.
I don't know how you haven't bought at least the audiobook like Trevor did.
See, Trevor bought the book right there.
Trevor bought the audiobook. Trevor just went, bam, I'm buying the audiobook. I did.
The audiobook, because that's my kind of reading.
That's fine.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I like when I'm in the car, I listen to audiobooks. I read a hardcover and then I have a Kindle also. I'm always like reading three books at the same time on three different platforms. It's nutty. I don't know
where you are. I'm old school. I need the book. I need
paperback is my favorite.
I need it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need
but,
it.
But
I can do the same thing right too. There.
I want to say one thing because again, I don't want to detract from veteran services. Like combat veteran, whether you went to war or not, that is irrelevant. It's when you are fluffing that resume to an extreme degree that it becomes problematic. Like everything that I've done is 100% truthful. Everyone knows, like the guys on base here, like they know my background and everything.
Yeah,
you can read all my entire story in the book, and it's been fact checked by not just one or two people. We're talking like I had to send it to guys who were in the Air Force, guys that were in the Navy, XYZ, like multiple fact checks. My problem is that when you inflate that service record, as opposed to like a great example for Pete, had Pete come in there and just been like, yeah, man, I served in Afghanistan. I did Navy intelligence. You know, I ran the compound with interrogation and stuff. I'd have been like, tight, dude. Dope. Like, cool. But instead, his little PR spin masters wanted to like, ooh, look at him. And then and at that point, that's when you lose your agency. That's when you lose your authenticity. So anyway, you're selling yourself. And like if I ever start selling myself and you're like it's like Bernie Sanders, like who's doing a tour on capitalism where he's charging like $100 to go to an anti-capitalism I'm like.
Yeah. You know, pay $100 to go to my anti-capitalism, rah-rah-rah event, which is ironic because it's capitalism that's allowing me to charge the $100.
Yeah, and I'm just like,
I'm not a hypocrite.
I'm not a hypocrite at all. Does not compete. So I'm just saying, be the person that you exactly are. Like, I'm exactly who I am, online and offline.
Authenticity. Authenticity.
The digital divide is allowing people to get away with stupid stuff. So anyway, I just had to preface that. Now back to the question at hand that Brandon asked with regard to the opening sequence. So the opening sequence in the book, this is going to give anything away. And it's, I think it'll be written more powerfully is, so I was in Organy, Afghanistan, which is Oregon and Shkin, which are right on the border of Pakistan. So a lot of times early in the war effort and even just beyond, you know, Taliban and Al-Qaeda would just do cross-border raids. They'd because Pakistan was a ally. I put that very loosely in air quotes. And they would just, they would go over there and hide, and then they'd, you know, come across the border and attack. So we just, they, when I arrived in Oregon E, everyone called it Rocket City because they would launch 107 millimeter rockets. I'm gonna show you guys something here real quick. This is a portion of the rocket that got me.
Jeez.
Holy fuck.
This is only about a quarter of it.
Yeah.
Got to make a necklace out of that.
But look what it does to the metal.
Like, yeah. Jesus.
But it's like a little paper ribbon, you know?
Now, holy shit.
The pieces of this flying everywhere.
Like a banana peel, eh? Yeah.
Shrapnel.
Yeah. So we smuggled this back.
And you got it all on your arm, too. You got it in your arm as well.
No, it was my lower back, but luckily my body armor stopped all that. Yeah, okay. And the back there, you can't see it, but there are the fragment pieces that they pulled from my body armor. So anyway, and then my
better
my
stories have, than I got. Slide
have a piece also. So they would launch these 107 millimeter rockets, which are Chinese made, and sometimes they would strap them either with you know, some form of explosive like TNT or C4, sometimes white phosphorus, which is it made them wildly inaccurate because if you're adding weight, you know, it's going to change the trajectory. So they were doing that. The day in question, it was like, I think it was like, I don't remember. It was like 50 or 60th rocket attack, something like that. You know, so I'm used to this. I'm like, oh, we're going to get in the bunker, whatever. These guys are idiots. Well, some of the locals, cause early on in the war effort, we would employ Afghans to do like, you know, wash our clothes, help the cooks with cooking, you know, stuff that we needed help with, you know, menial stuff around bakes. Hey, can you fix like the grounding to the water heater went out again? Cause we were used to taking cold showers and then you would get electrocuted too half the time, when you grab the nozzle. There's a story about that in the book. I'm not
gonna tell
you.
That's funny.
It's really funny. So, but
you just go back to the hockey dressing room and you're like, 100% we would do that to somebody.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, a group of them asked to leave early and we're like, well, that's weird. And then all of a sudden they leave within 30 minutes, we're getting hit, you know? And so they're trying to attack the base. Things are going bad. And the rockets at first, they go over the base. We're like, ha, 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 morons. They start landing inside the base. They start hitting bunkers. So they, and we're like, oh, no, they know where our strategic positions are. So
rats.
I have met up with Gonzo at this point. He's like, hey, I got to radio the team in Kandahar and let them know what's going on. And I'm going to stay with the commander and get sit reps as far as everything. You got to go get the rest of these local Afghans. We can't have them getting killed. Work with the intel guys. And we're going to, and like, don't go to a bunker, obviously. and the scene opens with me. I'd run out of my, the building where I was living in. And there's this young Afghan boy. Cause a lot of times the parents would bring their kids to work to make extra money for their families. And he had taken a piece of shrapnel to his chest. And we call that like a sucking chest wound because it collapses the lung. And you either have to put a little piece of flap over there so it creates that. Or if you're a medic, you have a bore needle to jam in. And then you've probably seen it where they twist it and the blood spouts out and then they can breathe finally again. So this medic's hovering over this young child. And he's about to jam that into his chest to relieve the pressure. And I'm like, oh no. So I do not go to the bunkers. I go to our chow hall, which is this building in the middle where we'd eat. And there's a section of wall that has like some of an oven and other stuff. And we figure that's a good spot. It's reinforced, but it's close to our tactical operations center, which was what they were really aiming for, and the tower there. And we get all the Afghans into this corridor. and all the, and our interpreters are there with us. And we walk in the room and it's me, this other guy, Max, that's not his real name. And another guy named Lopez, also not his real name. Max is one of my very best friends in the entire world. He's with the Joint Special Operations Command now. So that's why I can't release his name 100%. Or his info or anything. But, you know, we're joking, we're laughing. We're like, we've been through this before, which is kind of what you do when you get to that point. And we had, mind you, we're out in the middle of nowhere. So we're eating sea rations, which are terrible. And everybody gets dysentery while we're out there. So sometimes they fly in Dr. Pepper and Sprite, all the, you know, creature commodities that you're like, yes. So a new batch has just arrived and Lopez is walking out, drinking one. And Max looks at him and he's like, oh my God, you know, he's like, we got more. And, you know, shit's exploding around us and we're kind of chuckling. And he's like, yeah, man. He's like, new stock of the good stuff. So he goes in there, he grabs Dr. Pepper. He's like, I'm getting a Dr. Pepper and calling it a day. So he walks back in the room and we have finally moved everybody into this corridor. And I remember I was looking at Max and all of a sudden I think I hear like the faintest whistle and then blackness, you know? And I wake up. I don't know how long this has been. I have no idea where Lopez is either at this point, which was confusing. This is where everything is kind of really confusing. And even Max and I have like different ideas as far as what happened because we were injured. And he was like, yeah, he was like, because he read that section and he was like, yeah, you know, most of this makes sense, you know, but we were also like really effed up. So I wake up and there's his memory that is always in my head. It's this large Afghan man in a wool turban thing. And he is terrified. His eyes are the size of saucers. And he's like pointing at me and I like lean into the wall and I'm like waving him off. I'm like, shut the fuck up, you know, and I'm yelling at everybody and I can't hear a damn thing either. And I look down at my arms and I'm like, what is all this black and clear stuff on my arms? And I start like, you know, wiping it off because I'm just in a t-shirt at this point in body armor and like really short, what we call Ranger panties. And I'm like, what the hell? And so I start wiping and my hands start bleeding and my arms are bleeding a little bit. I'm just like, what is this? And I realized that the window had been blown out from where we were and had blown shrapnel all in and glass all into my forearms. It's very superficial. It's fine. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, everything, and I'm like groggy and everything's moving slow. And I'm like yelling at these guys. And they're like, I can tell the Afghans are yelling. And I'm like, Max, where the fuck are you? And I look down and there's like this Dr. Pepper trail. And this is funny because Max's wife and I, we always laugh about this. She's like, the part of the story that has never changed is the Dr. Pepper. So like for whatever reason that like really stuck for both of us. Well, Max had been blown through the door into the eating section and had been knocked over all these tables. And the pop can had like just gone everywhere. So there's just Dr. Pepper splattered to the moon and back. And I walk in there and it looks like a scene from The Walking Dead where there's this like blood trail leading over into a corner, and I find Max and he's sitting there and he's rocking back and forth, and his sleeve, because he has his uniform on, is bloody. And I come in there, and then I think Lopez runs in there at that point, and I'm like, yo, you gotta let me see, man. And he's yelling and I'm yelling, I can't hear him. And finally he, you know, he's rocking back and forth, he keeps telling me, I think my elbow's broken. And I was like, that's the least of your worries at this moment. There's blood everywhere. So I have this steel black dagger that I pull out of my body armor and we slice open, you know, his sleeve, and I lift his arm, and right here in his tricep, it looks like a pop can has exploded. And there's just like fatty muscle tissue. And I'm like, which is wild because like now that injury is like the size of this, it's like tiny. And I'm like, how did that happen? It's funny how the body closes up wounds. But like, yeah, fat and muscle tissue, and it's just blood. And I'm like, uh-oh, this is bad. So we like pick him up and, you know, we drape him around. So he's in the middle. I'm on one side. Lopez is on the other. And we like start walking him in and just blood's like dripping down. And prior to advancements in, you know, the Iraq and Afghan wars, we still had the Vietnam era, like pressure dressing wounded. And this is where muscle memory kicks in and will either save you or kill you. His had been blown off. I mean, it was a large explosion. Lopez and I, we still have our ours, but the training doctrine at the time was you never use yours on somebody else ever. Because if you get injured, then you have nothing to wrap yourself up with. So we're like, well, we got to find something. So we find some dish towels and we start packing it in there. We're finding like twine that they use to like for turkeys and stuff and just wrapping it around. Like we're creating our own makeshift pressure dressing. And I'm like, we got to get the medics. And they set up a triage rally point in the gym, which was right around the corner. It was no big deal. So I run out the back door, but we had just erected a wall there. And I run smack dab into it. I'm start pounding on it. All more rockets are coming in. They're getting closer. My hands start to tremble and I'm shaking at this point. I'm like, this is it. This is where we die. And so I run back into the room. And this is when the fear really, really begins to take me. I look at Max and I look at Max and Lopez and I'm like, I just scream at him. I go, they block access to triage. Where the hell do we go? And so I just go back to patching him up and my hands are trembling and I'm like, I'm not running out again. Like that's when the fear took me. I was like, I am not running out again. I've been blown up once. Lopez is fine. And I just look at him and I was like, it is your turn to get blown up. And so he's like kind of standing there and he's going to have to run out the way that we just, that you know, Max and I got injured. And he's like, all right. And he does it like a boss and he gets the medics. And this is kind of where I start going in and out of lucidity. I don't know how long it took, but he comes back with the medics. I'm patching up Max. You know, Max is asking for water. And luckily, you know, the training kicks in. I'm like, hey, man, I can't give you water because you'll go further into shock. It could shut your system down. We don't want that to happen. And he's like ghost white. There's blood loss. There's so much blood loss. And so Lopez comes in with the medics. The medics are totally freaked out too. We try and start an IV. Their hands keep shaking. We can't get an IV started. Finally, the Air Force calls in airstrike, ends the attack. We blow up the side of this mountain. The howitzers are firing into it. Like we're just dumping at this point. The quick reaction force is out the gate. We have to go get a litter. And I don't remember any of this at this point. Like literally just blackout city is where this happened. The last thing I remember are the medics trying to start an IV. This is all secondhand what I'm telling you from this point out. We get him on a medevac. I have no idea how we get him to a medevac. Apparently I carried him to the medevac along with Lopez and the other two medics, and just ran there. The helicopter arrives. They take him off. Gonzo finds me and like, I have, Max's rifle with me because you never lose the rifle. Otherwise it is a bad thing. Like even when you're wounded, make sure you get the rifle. and I'm like clutching his rifle to my chest, just standing there, like just vacant nothingness. And like, I'm like covered in blood, like mine, Max's, I don't have a freaking clue. And it's like crisscrossed kind of across my arm, you know, like looks like somebody had taken paint and splattered it like that, like where there's just lines and stuff. And Gonzo looks at me and he's like, hey man, are you okay? And I'm like, oh, I just got my bell rung, man. I'm good. He's like, well, you don't look good. I'm like, I'm good, man. And he was like, he's like, hey, like, don't move. And he like starts messing with my neck and I'm like swatting at him. And then like my hand starts to swell and then my comments become nonsensical. It's called word salad, where you start mixing stuff together. And so I start having word salad. I'm talking about violins and the attack and none of it makes any sense. And Gonzo's like, ah, crap. He's got a concussion. This is before we know about traumatic brain injuries. And so they take me over to the base medic and like, it's just a small, tiny hut where the surgeon and they're like, he's like, yeah, like you can see, and he went here. And, you know, and my hand, I'm like looking at it now. It's like looking from the hand from Everlong, the Foo Fighters, where it's like getting bigger. I like have this fat Buddha hand. I'm like staring at it. And I'm like, what is going on? Yeah. And they said I did what's called, you know, a common skateboarder fracture. Cause when I went head first in the wall, it smashed and then just fractured all this stuff in here. And so he was like, dude, I can't cast this here. And I was like, all right. And so they splint it. So I'm in a splint like this with my arm around it. I have photos of this. It's on my website, I think. And so they splint it and they're like, all right, call another medevac. They're like, we can't get him out. There are sandstorms in Kandahar and in Bagram and everything right now. Is he urgent critical? They're like, no. They're like, keep him on base until the sandstorm. So I have to sit on base fucked up for 3 days until they can get me out, and they have
to makeshift sling.
Yeah. And a makeshift sling. And I have to be, I also have to be in, they have to keep me awake for 24 hours to make sure I don't die from the head injury.
Oh my God.
So not only am I like just crazy at that point, like no sleep. And the worst part is they're like, hey, we need you to fill out a report about what happened so that we can put, you know, Max in for Purple Heart. And then, and I'm like, all right. And I like try and write, and it's like chicken scratch. And I have no idea. It's like probably the worst report ever. It's like rocket go boom. Yay. Yeah.
So feeling good.
Yeah. And then after that, they evacuated me to Kandahar. They cast my wrist there. I ended up choosing to stay. They gave me the option to go home. And I said, no, I can't leave the country while my team's still here. That just wouldn't be right. And I could have gone home for Christmas. It would have been dope. But I'm glad that I didn't, because Robin Williams showed up on Christmas Eve and did a surprise. So I got to see Robin Williams before he died perform.
That's comedy, wicked.
Which
That's
was wicked. Insane. And it was the coolest moment ever. Mm-hmm. Granted, I was higher than a kite because I was on like all this pain med. So
he probably was too.
Yeah, probably likely. But it was, you know, good, like kind of Bob Hope visiting the troops memory for me. And I was glad that I stayed, but I only had a month left in my tour of duty. And so they just, they let me answer phones in headquarters, and I would like sleep in there at night to answer sometimes. And then they would try and have me drive, the interpreters around in Kandahar, but that proved very difficult because I'm right-handed and my hand is in a cast, and you know, you drive on the wrong side. So it's the right side and it's a shifter. So I'm like trying to move a steering wheel and shift as far as everything. And like these, most of the time I would just make the interpreters drive. So I'd pick them up and be like, you got to drive, man. I'm effed up. And they're like, are you on drugs too? I was like, yeah, totally.
No, like a lot of people are just wanted to update you on the comments. A lot of people want the second episode. But you know what? We can all absolutely love to have you. We're going to have you back, but there's a couple more stories I want to ask.
Yeah.
Because this is phenomenal. You mentioned in the book,
phenomenally towards the crazy, end, just
you mentioned in the book, the stats, which is just, again, further proof that I did read the book, Collins, which is the statistics of you dying at war in the first 90 days of your tour and the last 30 days of your tour is the first one I want you to touch on. And the second, because a lot of people don't know that, and the second is the dog and pony show, which I'm not going to ruin the story in the book on a casualty that did end up happening on the dog and pony show. Okay. In Iraq, but
are you talking about the John McCain thing?
Yeah, that. Yeah. Well, and then they went on a black road, which they weren't supposed to, and it was all for the TV cameras.
That was all in North. Yeah, I'll talk about that.
That's, and then, that's but important just
to how we won. Yeah,
Well, and just it's more the what we see again on the media is what they want us to see. It's the dog and pony show. It's the milk run for all salespeople that are out there.
It's propaganda. Like in our psychological operations community, like civil affairs and psychological operations are under the same command. So there's a lot of crossover. And so it was the largest PSYOP campaign I've ever seen. Well, actually, I think the current media is the largest PSYOP campaign I've ever seen. Very successful.
I agree with that.
They're doing a great job. But
great job.
Sucks that they're doing it. So the first 90 days in a country are the most dangerous because you're just getting used to your surroundings. You don't know that, like, okay, is this an IED or is this just trash? You know, because everything looks like trash. Where do I go? And so what happens is typically within the first 90 days, that's when you have the most casualties. When you're well established into your kind of tour of duty already, it's a lot less unless you end up in a really kind of wicked scenario. Like I had a friend named Sergeant First Class Raymond Bouchon. He got killed during the Battle of Donkey Island. He was well on his way to probably like 9 months in country. And it was just crap luck, man. So sometimes that happens, but statistically the first 90 days and then the last 30 days is because you get complacent. You know that you're going home. And so you start to miss things. So out of that, like, and I know you asked this question earlier. I was married at the time, not to my current wife, my wife and I, now we've been married for 12 years, almost. And, my wife at the time, we had met while I was in college in the military, and, you know, she was a military brat, but she left which is pretty typical for guys overseas, unfortunately. About a month shy of me coming home, and that just put my head in a bad space. And so you become complacent. You're like, oh, well, I'm going home, and that you start missing stuff. You start missing the piece of wire that's sticking out of the ground. You start kind of checking out. And Wegner, who's my teammate, he pulled me aside one day, and you know, this is about 30 days, and he goes, hey man, we need to talk. And I was like, all right, what's up? And he goes, you know how sorry we are that your wife left you. And I was like, yeah, man, I know you guys you've been there. You've been a support. And he's like, look, man, I'm going to be honest with you. You're slipping. And I go to object, right? I go to object. And he holds up his hand and he's like, look, you know it. And I know it. You're missing things on mission that could come second nature. And he's like, I am so sorry, Sledge, that your wife left. He said, but if you don't pull it together, you're going to get us killed too. And he said, you know it, and I know it, that the last 30 days are the most dangerous. And if you keep slipping, one of us is going to die. And I was like, you're right. And so, like, had to bury that pain all deep down, just push it down and never bring it up kind of moment. And so... Yeah. So anyway, those are the statistics on that. And then the dog and pony show stuff. So what you see in the media a lot of times is not the reality of the situation on the ground. So the first kind of thing that really happened was we had this guy, his name's Captain Travis Patrick Quinn. There's a lot of information about this guy. He's a former Green Beret Special Forces soldier who switched over to civil affairs and was running the G5S5, which is the civil affairs aspect of the headquarters element in Ramadi during that time. He spoke Arabic, multiple languages, and he had smart, well-informed guy. We loved him. He had a plan to retake the Anbar province because it really focused in on the counterinsurgency operations. And being that it was the most violent city on earth, he said, look, this is the way that we do it. He said, we have all these tribal warlords here and sheikhs that basically run the police. They run, you know, the locals, all of that. And he said, we've destroyed their infrastructure. Now think about this. If the Chinese government came in and wrecked the infrastructure and we lose power, water, sewage, trash, you think we're going to rise up? Of course we're going to rise up. Like, you take away creature comforts, people get pissed. And so he's like, if we funnel projects to restore the infrastructure, And then on top of that, empower them to empower the people, and they look like the heroes, and we kind of take a back seat, then we'll win the war. And I was like, yeah, that's what we got to do. This is like the CA mission. This is how it, this is how we work, the civil affairs mission. And so we're like, this guy's got it. 100% game on. It starts to work. And we flip Sheikh Sitar Abu Risha, who's kind of a dirtbag. He was a tribal warlord. We had arrested him a ton of times, but he flips that dude. We start going over his house. He's like feeding us tea and like Turkish coffee and like all this other stuff. We start funneling him all these projects for his contractors to take care of. And we start shifting the tide of the war while we're there. And by the end, Ramadi had become the most pacified city because of the fact that we had restored 18 hours of consistent electricity per day. Water, sewage, and trash was running up again. So that's the success story on that side. But the media hears about this, right? So they bring in Ollie North and journalists from Newsweek. And they're like, we gotta capture the story of the Anbar Awakening. And they drive down Route Michigan, which is a black road. They clear it every night because it's a major thoroughfare throughout Ramadi. But it is black. They go down that road in broad daylight when a bunch of IEDs have been placed. And guess what happens? They fucking hit a daisy-chained IED. Catastrophic. Nothing left. They killed the first female Marine officer, Megan McClung. I'm friends with, funny enough, a guy that was really close with her. And I mean, it's just devastating. And I was like, he freaking died for a photo op with Ollie North. This was retarded. And I mean, I don't mean that in a sense, like, this,
no.
I mean, this is like,
yep.
Like that is very slow thinking. That is ignorance that we have done. We were very upset about that. So I begin, I'm like, what is up with this stuff? Then in Camp Ramadi, they have a regular landing zone, and then they create a VIP landing zone where all your congressmen, where all your senators get to come in and check on their Kellogg, Brown and Root investments. So this
the
story
chicken
is told,
shits.
Yeah. So this story is told secondhand by me. John McCain starts his run for, this is what his ramp up to announcing his presidency. And like, let me preface this. Love John McCain as a veteran. The service that he gave this country, absolutely incredible. Politics changed him, though, not for necessarily the better. I still think he had gall. I think he did a lot of things that had integrity as a politician and stood up when needed to be, but he also still played the game. And if you look at his history and like how he like left his wife for like the heir of Anheuser-Busch and kind of did some crappy stuff, you'll see he was flawed too. Like all of us have these flaws. But because he realized politics is playing politics and you got to put stuff on camera. And this story is told to me. I tell it through the lens of Kip McVeigh, who was down at Camp Corregidor. So they want to get in on the Anbar Awakening too. So it's like them, and I think it's like people from CNN, they start doing like, oh, look at how Ramadi has been beautified. So the command decides that before they get there, we need to paint T-barriers. T-barriers are blast walls. They're concrete blast walls. So they hire locals to make it look all pretty, even though there's just raw sewage running throughout the street. And we are still in an urban combat warfare. So this is early.
Trying to put some lipstick on it.
Yeah. They're putting lipstick on the war pig. This is early 2007. And this is like the closing engagement during the Battle of Ramadi. It was Operation Murfreesboro. So before Operation Murfreesboro, he shows up with his film crew and Kit's out there. And he's like, I'll never forget this. He was like, they're standing in knee deep raw sewage talking about like how beautiful like Ramadi's getting and how we're changing the war effort and everything. Had they walked 100 yards forward, there was like this area called like Eagle's Nest. There's a literally like a demarcation zone where you didn't pass that line because you would get shot dead by insurgent snipers. So had he just walked 100 yards forward, he would have been shot dead. And so he's standing in knee deep trash. They're filming what they want to film so that it goes back to the American public, all neatly tied in a bow. Meanwhile, all of us are getting killed there. And then the next week or two, Kit goes out, goes on Murfreesboro, and like has to hold in some kid's brain. A 19-year-old kid's brain is in because he got shot in the head. But right. You know, it's pretty. At least we're painting tee barriers.
So it's absurd.
Yeah,
absurd.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and I think this is why, you know, and I'm not saying this because we have one, but I'm just saying this is why I think there's a rise of podcasts, is because, you know, we know that there's a, you know, an editor, a master editor, and there's a master producer, and there's the, you know, the big, you know, what we want the people to see behind the scenes. You know, and if it wasn't for my, like I said, I've been, JJ and I were, friends before he joined the army, before he was a paratrooper. And we stayed in contact when I was in Australia, and then he was stationed in Italy. And then they would fly in to Afghanistan. And, you know, it's just, you hear this and you sound a lot like him too. Like even some of the slang and the vernacular. And this is not for anyone that's listening. I've heard this from multiple people, including one of my dear friends, 25 years, who texted me this morning saying he's almost done your book as well. I think he's I don't know why, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's a full-time teacher, three girls too. So, but he's saying a lot of the stories are hitting home, right? And you hit on a lot of good things, because I just see a lot of likeness between the two of you. And just, yeah, you guys are just you guys aren't the SEAL team or the Green Berets. You guys are literally, I hate the term bottom of the totem pole, but you are. Like, you're the ones that do the grunt work. And no one
you're in the trenches. Story.
You literally are in the trenches. And this book, again, Amazon.ca, support a vet, help a vet, where cowards go to die.
Movie to come out or a series, right, Sledge?
I would love for, like, if you're in Hollywood and you're listening to this and you want a mini series, like, by all means. I think
Matthew McConaughey could play it. It'd be perfect.
Oh, Matthew McConaughey.
He would be too old, man. You would absolutely. Have to be a 20-year-old.
His son, maybe.
Yeah.
He could be talking about his past experiences.
Yeah, but I think Matthew McConaughey could do the another version of the audiobook, just because of it, and just have him drive a Lexus. That'd be good. Right,
I used to live in Austin, Texas, funny enough. So
yeah, there you go. Definitely. Yeah, all right.
They stay.
Definitely, I think Ryan Reynolds should do this. Ryan Reynolds or Matt Damon. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck could write a great script.
Matt Damon.
Again, Team America. Thank you. Amazon.ca. Benjaminsledge.com. BenjaminSledge.com if you want your autographed book, and that again goes right to you.
I could listen to these stories for hours. Hours.
The thing is we got to maybe try and tee them up to get them on again, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, we're 100%. Can we have you on again? There's people that are saying that they want you to come on again.
Sure.
Maybe in a
we
couple
can even
months.
Talk geopolitics and the world, like
100%.
Stuff like that.
That's crazy.
You know, I just want to end this, Sledge, and I say this to JJ all the time. I love you, man. I love everything about you guys. I love the vets. I will do anything for a vet. I will work my ass off and pay more tax for as long as if I knew it went to a vet. Thank you for all that you do. It's not lost on any of us here. And everyone that's watching, this is why you buy a poppy, you know? This is why you buy a poppy up
this
in
Canada.
This is
why you buy the book. Buy the book and read why it. You buy experience the book. It. Experience it. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear. I love to hear from my readers. So, like, you can find me on all my social media channels. You can drop me a line at on my website. There's a contact form. I like to. I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, I'm too big for whatever. I want to connect with people because I would rather be the honest, authentic person that allows that and has that opportunity to connect with people, because, you know, all of us go through struggles in life. It's just, we deal with them differently, or they're similar yet different. So I realize, like, my experience is unique, but our experiences as humans are not unique.
My word for it
well,
is not love.
Stay on my, after we got to wrap this up, but because, yeah. But stay on after our link will be live. Like, we can chat, and I want to know what Rookie has to say. Cause, you know, Rookie, without Rookie, we wouldn't have a podcast. We wouldn't have anything. So thank you, Rookie. Mm-hmm. Thank you to our sponsors, Brand Boulevard, Bondo. Take us out.
My word for you is not love. It's respect for what you've done and what you're continuing to do with your fellow men. So
well, I appreciate you guys' support. It means a lot.
Help us help you stay informed. Out.
Ciao.
Do, did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Produced by Crier Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.